All right. Hey, it's great to be with you. I'm Glenn Barnes. I'm the lead pastor here at First Baptist, and we have been working our way through a series in the book of 1 Corinthians that we are calling Essential Church. And so if you want to go ahead and open your Bible up to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I think you'll find one of the more freeing truths in all of the gospel there at the very end of that chapter. So you may remember from last week that Paul had been giving some really direct and strong instruction to the Corinthians about what the purity of their life should look like as Christians. And as he comes to the end of that chapter, he adds this little nugget, and he says this. He says, don't forget that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. And then he says this, you are not your own. You have been bought at a price. In other words, he says, you belong to God. So honor God with your body. And I say that that's such a freeing truth because I don't know about you, but if I could ever really wrap my mind around this idea that my life belongs to God, then I can start to live with the sense that who I am and what I do is a part of something bigger than just me. That the decisions that I make, that the purpose of my life, that the purpose of my day for that matter, it can be directed by something more than just kind of whatever whims come my way or my own self-interest. But because God paid this high price for me, and since I belong to Him, I can go ahead and I can say that my life is for Him. And so God, go ahead and have your way with my life. And if you think about that, that is a really freeing way to look at life, that my life belongs not to myself, but my life belongs to God. Now, of course, that can also be very challenging because the implications of that are also that then whatever God has for me, whether whatever He has for me, whatever story He writes for me is not a mistake because I have to believe that God strategically oversees my life. And even purposely puts me in the right time and the right place and in the right circumstances so that I can make Him known and so that I can live for Him. So, for example, in Acts chapter 17, the Apostle Paul, who wrote 1 Corinthians, and we're trying to understand the mindset of Paul. And so in Acts chapter 17, Paul preaches one of his most important sermons and one of his most famous sermons. And he doesn't do it to actually a group of Christians. He doesn't deliver this sermon in a church, but he actually delivers it in the town of Athens at a place called Mars Hill, which is like the marketplace or the center for kind of intellectual discussion and intellectual debate. And I think it's so cool that Paul goes right to the heart, not only the center of Athens, but really he goes right to the heart of the Roman Empire to deliver this message. And a part of this sermon that he gives in Acts chapter 17, he says this. He says, don't forget that God sets us in our time. So in other words, God is intentional in the time that He places us in history. So what that means is 2020 has been a tough year, right? 2020 is difficult. And sometimes we wish that I wasn't a part of it. And yet it's not by accident. God knew what He was doing when He put you and He put me in 2020. And so He says, God sets us in our time and He draws our boundary line. So He sets us in the place that we live as well. Why? So that perhaps people might reach out and find Him. So in other words, Paul says, God has you where you are for a reason. So you might as well reach out to Him. You might as well grab a hold and you might as well follow Him. And so this is a core belief for the Apostle Paul. To understand any of Paul's writings, it's important for us to understand this core belief and what you would call the sovereignty of God. Paul believes that God controls his life. And because he knows that God has got him and holds him, that allows for a second core belief that's very important to Paul. And that is because God is in control of his life, then he can learn to be content no matter what the situation is. In fact, he famously writes in Philippians 4, he says, I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether I'm well-fed or hungry, whether I'm living in plenty or whether I'm living in want. I can do all this through Him who gives me strength. In other words, I can be content because God is holding my life. And then he says the same kind of thing in 1 Timothy 6. He says, godliness with contentment is great gain. He says, we brought nothing into this world and we can take nothing out of it, so learn to be content. And so Paul holds fast to these two core values that as a part of his worldview, that he says that based on the sovereignty of God, that we can trust that he is in control. And because he is in control and guiding our life, what that means is we can be content and we can be at peace and even satisfied wherever we are in life. And this is all very important because today in our study of 1 Corinthians, we come to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, if you know anything about 1 Corinthians chapter 7, you know that it is considered one of the most colorful and honestly one of the most controversial chapters in all of the New Testament. The main topics of 1 Corinthians chapter 7 are sex, marriage, singleness, divorce, circumcision, and slavery. You know, easy stuff like that. And for years, people have turned to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 to kind of dig deep into the details of those specific controversial issues. And so you approach it almost like you would an encyclopedia. I want to get the information on that specific issue. And honestly, for years, that is the way that I have approached this chapter. And it's not really the best way to approach this chapter. You see, this week, as I have studied it in more depth, I confess that I have seen this chapter in a whole new light than I have ever seen it before. Because rather than just dwell on the nitty-gritty details of sex or marriage or singleness or whatever topic it is, I've been able to see a larger picture and how it relates to Paul's worldview, right? That is governed by God's sovereignty, that God's in control of his life. And so because God is in control, he can learn to be content. You see, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is a classic passage where you could, as they say, miss the forest because of your attention to the trees. You can miss the big picture because you're so focused on the smaller details. And so what we're going to do is I want to give you kind of a 10,000 foot perspective that I found to be super helpful to understanding what Paul is trying to get across in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, our passage for today. And so I think kind of the big idea for this whole chapter is that we are supposed to bloom where we are planted. And you may want to even write that down. We are to bloom where we are planted. Wherever you are in life, it's less about changing your circumstances and it's more about making the most of the circumstances that you are in. So bloom where you are planted. And to kind of demonstrate how this theme runs through this chapter and really holds this chapter together, I want to just read a series of verses real quick through 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And if you're the kind of person who likes to mark up your Bible, you might want to circle or highlight some key words here as we go through this. So remember, at the end of chapter 6, Paul reminds us that we have been bought at a great price. And so our life doesn't belong to us. Our life belongs to God. And so in chapter 7, he says, "And now about the issues that I have written to you, or the matters that I wrote, that you wrote about." Remember, Paul's having this conversation back and forth based on some questions that the Corinthians had written him and how he starts to address some of those things. So like, for instance, in verse 8, he says this. He says, "Now to the unmarried," talking about single people, "to the unmarried and to the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do." And again, we want to just dig right into the details of that, but I want you to circle one word. It's kind of the most important word there. It is the word stay. He says, whatever situation you're in, stay in that situation. Verse 10, same kind of thing. He says, "Now to the married people," he says, "I give you this command, not I, but the Lord." So in other words, this is something that Jesus himself had specifically talked about. He said, "A wife must not separate from her husband." And I circle the phrase "must not separate" because it's got that same connotation of they must stay or be content in the situation that they're in. Verse 12, same kind of thing. He says, "Now to the rest, I say this, I, not the Lord." So in other words, this is not something that Jesus specifically spoke to, but Paul says, "I'm an apostle as well." And so now Paul is writing and he says, "If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, then he must not divorce her." And I circled "must not divorce her." It's the same concept as "not leave" or "must not separate" or "must stay." Verse 15, to the unbeliever, he says, "If that unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or sister is not bound in such circumstances." Let it be so speaks to the ability to be at peace, whatever the situation is. And then verse 17, which I really think is kind of the heart of this whole chapter, Paul writes and he says this, "Nevertheless, each person should live as a believer in whatever situation the Lord has assigned to them, just as God has called them." right? So whatever situation you're in, whatever God has assigned you, you should live as a believer in that situation. He says, this is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not become circumcised. I guess circumcision, or in other words, the even kind of the ethnic identity of a person, whether they were a Jew or a Gentile, he says that's nothing and it amounts to nothing. He says, but keeping God's commands is what counts. So verse 20, each person should remain in the situation that they were in when God called them. Verse 21, you were a slave, or were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. Although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For the one who was a slave when called to faith in the Lord is the Lord's freed person. Similarly, the one who was free when called is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. So do not become slaves of human beings. Brothers and sisters, each person, as responsible to God, should remain in the situation that they were in when God called them. And I'll go ahead and stop there, because the point is, verse after verse, you see the same theme no matter what the situation is. And it's this idea that they are to trust in God's control. They are to learn to be content and remain in whatever situation they're in, and to bloom where they are planted. Bloom where they are planted. So this summer, I've been in this slow process at my house of completely redoing our backyard. So it's been this long, much slower process than I ever imagined. So I tore a bunch of the old plants and stuff out of the backyard. And then where we're adding some new stuff, I also have let just all of that stuff die. I just stopped watering it, stopped taking care of it. And so it's a big mess in a part of the yard. And yet, even out of the mess of this place that nobody's taking care of, in the last few weeks, I've noticed this incredible thing, that there are these flowers that are sprouting up. And there are these big, beautiful sunflowers that have grown up even out of the mess. And in the last week or so, they've bloomed. And there are these big, blue, beautiful yellow flowers that have grown up right out of the middle of the mess. And I don't even know how they got there. I don't know how they're surviving. But what I know is they are blooming right where they are planted, and they are beautiful. And that's the kind of thing that Paul says to us. Your life may feel like it's a mess sometime. Your relationship, your living situation, it may feel like a mess. But whatever situation that you're in, God is with you. And you can bloom, and you can thrive, and you can make something beautiful. So we're going to get to some of the topics of this chapter, the specifics, in just a little bit. But before we do that, I want to give us three principles that are really a part of Paul's theology that we see not only here in 1 Corinthians 7, but we see it throughout Paul's writing. So these are kind of big picture principles that when we understand these things, it'll help us to really understand 1 Corinthians 7. So three big picture principles. The first one is this: God sovereignly places us in the situations that we are in. That's what we've been talking about all along. Like Paul said on Mars Hill, he says, God sets the times and the boundaries of our lives. And so you see this in 1 Corinthians, where he talks about your marriage relationship, or whether you're single, or whatever your status is. He talks about your ethnic or your cultural background when he talks about whether you're circumcised or not. He talks about our job or our social status in life. And over all of this, his advice is you have to learn to make the most of wherever you are. So the topic is contentment, and that's really what he's writing about. But I also want to just say very clearly, as we talk about especially being content and staying in our marriages, this is not Paul saying that you have to stay in an abusive marriage. And in fact, that is a different situation. And for far too long, the church has done a poor job of coming alongside, especially women that are in those kind of difficult situations. And if that is you, we encourage you to reach out to get some help. Because even as Paul talks about blooming where you're planted and making most of your situation, he's not talking about that abusive or that harmful place that you might be. I also want to be real clear with something. Paul is not saying, when he talks about contentment, Paul is not saying that we can never change things if we're in a bad situation. In fact, as much as we're talking about contentment, there's also a time for what is sometimes called a holy discontent, or some people call it a righteous anger. In fact, the example that Paul uses in this passage is an especially loaded one for us these days, because Paul talks about slavery of all things. Now, throughout history, people have used these verses to justify the evil and the inhumane treatment of slaves, which is wrong. It is always wrong. That is not what Paul, that is not what Jesus is ever about. Christians were rightly at the forefront of the abolitionist movement, both in the United States, in England, and we should still be on the forefront. Christians should be in standing up for people who are oppressed in all kinds of situations. But when Paul wrote this, first to the city of Corinth, probably about half of the city would have been considered slaves. And while the slavery was different then than it was in American slavery over the last 200 years, it was still not God's design for them. And so Paul says, if you can get out of that situation, go ahead and do it. Go for it. That there can be a discontentment to improve your situation in that case if you can. In fact, we are at an important moment in our nation's history where we can be described, or what we're going through can be described as a time of righteous discontent. To say that when it comes to racial injustice, it's not okay for things to just continue on without change. Now, you may disagree with some of the way that a discontentment is being expressed, but this idea that to be discontent with the situation that needs to be changed is a biblical value as well. And yet, in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul is not talking so much about societal change, where Christians need to lead the way in terms of love and wisdom. But here he's not talking about societal change as much as he's talking about our own personal situations and how we can make the most of whatever situation we're in. Why? Because God is sovereign. God is in control, and we can be content and we can learn to bloom where we are planted. And so Paul has this belief in the sovereignty and that God places us in the situations that we are in. Along those lines, a second kind of theological foundation for Paul is this, that wherever you are in life, you are not there by accident, but you are there on assignment. And isn't that a powerful concept, that we are not where we are by accident, but we are there by assignment? Because I don't know where you are in your marriage situation. I don't know where you are in your job situation. I don't know where you are in your living situation, but I know it's not by accident, it's by assignment. And God wants to use you wherever you are. I think again of the Apostle Paul, and a lot of Paul's life, especially at the end of his life, he spent it in prison. And Paul never liked prison. Paul never wanted to go to prison. But even when Paul was in prison, what you saw is he didn't, you know, just lie down. He didn't just whine and complain. But Paul had this attitude, how can I be productive even in this situation that I'm in? And one of the things that Paul did is Paul wrote letters even from, you know, these difficult situations in a prison cell. And about half of Paul's letters, which make up so much of the New Testament, are things that Paul wrote from a prison cell because he knew that even in that hard situation, he wasn't there by accident, but he was there on assignment. And so how can he make the most of it? Which brings us to the third kind of theological a truth that Paul bases so much of his teaching on, which is this, that our Christian growth and our Christian testimony is more important than our circumstance. In other words, what God is doing in us, what God is doing through us, is more important than the circumstances or the situations that we're in. Now, if we're honest about that, most of us know that when we are in a bad situation, we spend way more of our time and energy thinking about how we could, you know, get out of that circumstance, rather than thinking, how can I grow? How can, you know, how can I have a testimony in these kind of situations? We tend to want to just get out of those bad situations. That's natural. But what Paul says is what God is doing in you is maybe even more important than the situation that you're in. You know, I think about these last 4 months that we've gone through as a nation, that we've gone through as a world. We've been through so much. Nobody is happy about this pandemic that we've been through. There's been much suffering. There's been much difficulty. No one is happy about it. And yet we've said time and time again that even out of these difficult situations, it's been so great to see some beautiful things come out of it. And so out of the disappointment of having to shelter in place came the beauty of families spending time together, right? And family dinners and family game nights came out of something, you know, that originally didn't seem like something good. Out of the frustration of quarantine came creative ideas like a drive-by celebration or a graduation parade or just a whole new level of connection and creativity and humor and all those things, whether it's on the internet or by video or those kind of things. Out of the sickness, though that sickness was really mourned, out of this virus, it also gave us a chance to do some great things, to show love to healthcare workers, to shop for our neighbors, to care for the elderly, whether they're in our church or in our neighborhoods, to make masks for people that need them. I've shared this example in our Wednesday night midweek check-in, but in my neighborhood throughout this this shelter-in-place time, we've been playing neighborhood quarantine bingo. And so the way it works is everybody comes out to just their driveway, and there's several families all around, and one person calls out bingo numbers, and we all play bingo. Everybody brings prizes, and out of this difficult situation, honestly, I could say that our neighborhood has never been as close as we have been in the last 25 years that I've lived there than we have in this time. Why? Because even out of a difficult situation, great things can happen. And so Paul says, don't become consumed by your circumstances, right? Don't focus only on those things, but rather focus on how you can bring the most out of any situation. So in other words, don't just grumble about the pile of lemons that you have, but get ready to do something great. Be looking for a recipe for lemonade. And so those are kind of the foundational things. That's kind of the forest, if you will. But what about the specific trees? And for our remaining few minutes, I do want to look at some of the details, because Paul does write to answer specific questions and about specific situations. So let me just address three of those real quickly as we begin to wrap up this message. So three specific situations that are addressed in 1 Corinthians. And the first one, Paul writes specifically to single people, to people that are unmarried, and he writes about the value of being single, or the value of singleness. So let me read verse 7 that says this. Paul says, I wish that all of you were as I am, talking about being single. He says, but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift and another has another. Now to the unmarried and to the widows, I say it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they can't control themselves, they should marry. For it's better to marry than to burn with passion. And so Paul there and in other places in chapter 7, he gives advice about the value of being single. And three things that Paul says specifically. He says, stay single if you can. If you're single, he says, stay single if you can. He says, I wish that your life was like mine. And Paul is talking there about being single. We know that Paul was unmarried at this time. We don't know if Paul was never married throughout his life. In fact, you would suspect that someone that rose as high as he did in the ranks of Judaism, that he might have been married in his past, and whether he had a wife that had died or maybe even had a wife that left him when he became a Christian, we don't know. But Paul says, now I'm single, and there's great value in it. And he gives a few reasons for that. And one of the main reasons he gives is says that marriage can undercut your ability to serve God. He says when you're single, you have the time and you have the focus where you can really devote yourself to serving God. And I know in my life, I experienced this. I think back to even before I was married, when I was single, I was a volunteer youth leader. And man, I spent all kinds of time doing youth ministry and hanging out with high school kids at all hours and going on trips and doing all kinds of crazy things. And then I got married and all that fun was sucked right out of my life. No, wait, that's not what I meant to say. What I meant to say is that suddenly, I had a new focus as far as the most important human relationship that I had, right? After my relationship with God, now was my relationship with Jannie. And so it came a change in ministry priorities. The same kind of thing happened when we had kids. Jannie and I, for a time, were in youth ministry and just had some great memories during that time. But then as kids started to be born, again, that started to change the focus there. And so Paul says, one of the great things about being single is the focus that you can give to other people. Now, he does go on to say that if you want to get married, and implied in that is if you can find the right person, not just that you rush into something, but if you can find the right person, Paul also says this, go ahead, you are free to marry. Now, in our modern world, and especially in a town like Lodi, and especially in a church like First Baptist, I imagine for the single person, sometimes it can feel kind of difficult. And whether that person is single by choice or maybe they really wish that they were married, this I know for a fact, that as a church family, we all need each other. In fact, I am so grateful for a number of really great friends and really great encouragers that are single and that are a part of this church. In fact, I would say to married couples, or I would say to families, it's so important that we expand our circles beyond just people that are just like us. But there are so many great single people that are a part of this church, and we are better together. And to single people, I would say to take that risk and to expand your circles beyond yourself, because we are so much better than we are together. And Paul talks about the value of single people in the church, and I would affirm that 100%. The next group that Paul talks to is Christian couples. And so he's talking to people that are married, that are both Christians, and he talks about the sacred beauty of marriage. The sacred beauty of marriage. And he does this by bringing up a couple things. The first thing that Paul talks about as he talks about the sacred beauty of marriage is about sexual intimacy. And apparently, the Corinthians had written a question to Paul about sex and said, hey, when a person becomes a Christian, should they just abstain from that altogether? And Paul's answer is absolutely not. In fact, his instruction to Christian couples is that sexual intimacy is meant to be an essential and a regular part of your marriage. Now, don't worry, we're not going to get too deep into this, especially as we've been watching online or as a church together. We know that there's mixed audiences here. I'm not looking to embarrass mom and dad. I'm not looking to embarrass the couples. But as I said, the Corinthians asked this question, should Christian couples abstain? And Paul's answer is heck no. He describes this more clearly in verses 1-5. And I would just encourage a married person to read through those things. And let me just encourage you, you don't read through those things as a club to beat up your spouse or as a guilt trip for your spouse, but rather to read through those and see the sacred beauty of the covenant relationship of marriage. And so Paul talks about that. And because of that, he says another thing to Christian couples, that we are to stay together even when it's rocky. So let me read verse 10. He says this, "To the married, I give this command." Again, not I, but the Lord. So in other words, he's reiterating what Jesus taught. He said, "A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife." And as you read that, again, you see the sacred beauty of your marriage, that it's this covenant relationship that is meant to last forever, that you make these vows before God, till death do us part. I loved as Wayne and Karen talked about their view of marriage. That's just the way that they approached it. And now 55 years later, that doesn't mean that they never had rocky times, but what it means is that as they value that covenant, out of that comes great beauty. And I can say from my own life, as well as from just the data that shows this time and time again, that a couple that can make it through even a rocky time can find a much greater depth and intimacy in their marriage. And so Paul says to the married couples, he says there's a sacred beauty in your marriage, so stay together, even if it's rocky, and even if it takes work, and it does take work, absolutely. And then there's a third group that Paul addresses, and these are two Christian people that are married, but they're married specifically to non-believers. And Paul's advice to them is, again, about the sacred beauty of their marriage, but also about the sacred opportunity in their marriage. So again, he talks about sexual intimacy as essential and a regular part of the marriage. He talks about staying together if it's rocky, but he also talks about this idea that the Christian spouse brings this spiritual blessing to the home. That if a believer is married to a non-believer, that they bring this spiritual value to their marriage and to their kids. And again, there are so many great people in our church family that I know and love and just think the world of that are in these kind of situations, that are doing their best not to preach at their spouse, but to follow the pattern that we see in 1 Peter chapter 3, which is to demonstrate from our life a beauty that comes from our relationship with God, an inward beauty that actually is the thing that points our spouse to Christ. And so to those couples, we stand with you as a church, and we love you, and we are there with you to pray with you and for you, and to support that important and sacred marriage that you are in. Well, as we close today, our worship team is going to play one more song. And it's a new song that we've never sung before as a church. Maybe you've heard it somewhere along the line. The song is called Rattle. And it's about the rattle of dead bones coming back to life. It's based on not only the resurrection of Jesus, but on the image that Ezekiel gives of dry bones that God calls back together and brings back to life. And that's what we need to hear today, because some of us are in that situation and it feels like my life is like dry bones. And maybe it feels like my marriage or my family is like dry bones. Hear God saying to you that he can bring those things back together and he can bring life. Can we learn to trust God? Can we learn to be content? And can we learn to say, because my life belongs to God, that I can follow him and I can sacrifice and I can give my life away on behalf of my wife, on behalf of my husband, on behalf of my family, because I know that God is good and God holds me and he's in control.